This evening, we're continuing our overview of the Old Testament book titled 2 Chronicles. With this as the focus, if you would, let's open our Bibles to 2 Chronicles chapter 25. And as you make your way to the 25th chapter of 2 Chronicles, I just want to take a moment to remind you that we find ourselves in a section of Scripture which is focused on the days when the nation of Israel was divided up into two distinct kingdoms. And the reason why was because the Lord was punishing them for their idolatries. Well, it's true that the Israelites in the northern kingdom of Israel were completely given over to the worship of idols. The Jews who were living in the southern kingdom of Judah, they were also continuing to waver in their faith, and they were wavering between their loyalty to the Lord and the temptation to worship the false gods of the pagan nations. And now here in our text tonight, we find King Amaziah. He's leading the kingdom of Judah back into the sin of idolatry. Now, as we consider the way that Amaziah wavered in his loyalty to the Lord, we would all do well to notice how the kingdom of Judah ended up suffering simply because they were being led by a man who was leaning on his own understanding. And as we consider his failure of faith, it's my hope that we might all remember that those who lean on their own understanding are going to falter in their faith, and they're going to fall. Conversely, those who trust in the Lord with all of their heart, well, we get to receive the divine direction that we need so that we can move forward in faith, making good and godly decisions. And with this as our goal, if you would, let's turn our attention now to Ezra's account, which is found here in 2 Chronicles. If you would look with me here at 2 Chronicles chapter 25, I want to begin reading at verse 1. Here we learn that Amaziah was 25 years old when he became king. And he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jehoadan of Jerusalem. And he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, but not with a loyal heart. Now here in the beginning of this chapter, we're reintroduced to Amaziah, the son of King Joash. And I'll remind you, it was actually in the final section of 2 Chronicles 24. There we learned about the day when the Syrian army left King Joash on the battlefield severely wounded. And after he was brought back to Jerusalem, then his own servants conspired against him. And the reason why is because he had killed the sons of Jehoiada, the priest. And so it was at that point in time when he was killed in his own bed, and his son Amaziah then started to reign in his place. And now, here in our text tonight, we learn that Amaziah was 25 years old when he became the king of Judah. But what's even more important, well, it's found there in verse 2, where we again learn that Amaziah did what was right in the sight of the Lord, but not with a loyal heart. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord, but his heart wasn't completely committed to the Lord. I like the way that the scholars who created the New English translation rendered verse 2. They put it like this: he did what the Lord approved, but not with wholehearted devotion. In other words, Amaziah was a king who was wavering in his commitment to the Lord. And it was this lack of loyalty to the Lord that led to his eventual downfall. Now, with this as the focus, let's continue to consider the wavering faith of King Amaziah. If you would look with me again here at 2 Chronicles chapter 25, I want to pick back up at verse 3. Here we learn that it happened as soon as the kingdom was established for him, that he executed his servants who had murdered his father, the king. However, he did not execute their children, but did as it is written in the book of the law of Moses, where the Lord commanded, saying, the fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall the children be put to death for their fathers, but a person shall die for his own sin. Now, here in these verses, we learn about this day when King Amaziah executed these men who had murdered his father. And while there was biblical justification for carrying out this capital punishment, Amaziah was also careful to refrain from the unrighteous revenge which would have led him to execute the children of those murderous men. With this in mind, we should notice again there in verse 4 where Ezra informs us that Amaziah did not execute their children, but did as it was written in the law in the book of Moses. The law that Amaziah was obeying here, well, it's actually found in Deuteronomy chapter 24. It's verse 16 where Moses declares, "Fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall children be put to death for their fathers. A person shall be put to death for his own sin." Now, here in this verse, we find Moses, he's helping the Israelites to understand that it's an act of injustice for children to be executed for the sins of their father. Just let that sink in for a second. It's an act of injustice. It's not just for a child to be executed for the sins of their father. And with that being the case, listen, King Amaziah did what was right in the sight of the Lord in this occasion. He spared the lives of the children of those men who had murdered his father. And this was a bit uncommon during this day and age. It wasn't uncommon for a king to go kill his enemies and their children and their children's children and so on down the line. But King Amaziah, he did what was right in the sight of the Lord here. He obeyed the law of Moses. And as we consider this law that the Lord gave in order to protect the lives of innocent children, we ought to take a moment to consider how this applies to the murderous medical procedure, which is commonly called abortion. You know, more often than not, Christians are quick to insist that abortion is a barbaric act which ends the life of an innocent child. I think for the most part, Christians agree on this. But then many Christians begin making concessions when it comes to the conversation about the abortion exemption, which is oftentimes applied to rape and incest. You'll oftentimes hear people say, well, in the case of rape or in the case of incest, yeah, okay, you know, abortion's okay. And there are Christians, even leaders in the church, who will make that argument. Now, let me just say this, that I know that this is an extremely sensitive subject. And so let me first say that the men who rape women should be severely punished. I have a few ideas. In my strong opinion, you know, the current punishment for rapists, it isn't strict enough. And with that being the case, it oftentimes fails to discourage those who might act upon these twisted and sick desires. With that being the case, it's sad to say that, you know, one out of six women, according to one poll, one out of six women here in the United States have either been raped or they've suffered an attempted rape. And that's just completely unacceptable. I think we ought to ramp up the punishment. You know, like in some countries, if you get caught stealing, they'll cut off your hand. So I'm kind of thinking in that direction. But listen, according to one study, 5% of rapes result in pregnancy. Some say the number's a little bit lower than that, but upwards of 5% of rapes result in an unplanned pregnancy. Now, listen, my heart breaks. My heart breaks for every woman who has suffered at the hands of the evil men who commit this horrifying crime. And I can't even begin to imagine the emotional pain of the woman who discovers that the rape she just endured has resulted in pregnancy. And I realize that there are many Christians who try to solve this situation by insisting that abortion ought to be allowed in the case of rape and incest. But I would just say, hold on, let's slow down a little bit, because there's still some important questions that we ought to ask. One important question that we ought to consider is this. What would the Lord say about this? What would the Lord say about those who abort an unborn baby because the father was a rapist? I might present the question in this way. Aren't those who defend the abortion exception in these cases of rape and incest, aren't they actually allowing an innocent baby to be executed for the horrific crime of their father? And if that's the case, then can a Christian correctly support the practice of abortion with these exemptions of rape and incest? Now listen, I get it. You know, this is an extremely sensitive subject, which is difficult to process. And it's difficult to process on many different levels. And there are those who are quick to insist that we must spare the victim from further emotional pain. And I get that argument. You know, there are those who are quick to say that, listen, there's no reason to make the victim of rape then endure 9 months as she continues to carry the fetus to full term. And on the surface, you know, this argument, it appears to make perfect sense on an emotional level. I mean, if we're just looking at this on an emotional level, then yeah, I get it. But I'd like to present you with another point of view, because listen, I believe this argument is short-sighted, and it actually fails to consider the trauma which will also be caused by abortion. You might not know this. I hope you don't. But abortion is traumatic to every woman. But don't take my word for it. No, instead, I would appeal to the research of Dr. David Reardon and his associates, who together spent time interviewing 192 women who had experienced pregnancy as the result of rape or incest. What they discovered during these interviews was this. Nearly all the women who conceived due to rape or incest then had abortion said they regretted it. Nearly all of them said they regretted it. Of those giving an opinion, over 90% said that they would discourage other victims of sexual violence from having an abortion. On the other hand, of the women who conceived due to rape or incest and then carried to term, not one expressed regret about her choice. I'm guessing that the bulk of these babies were given up for adoption, and I get that. But not one of the women who conceived due to rape or incest and carried them to term, not one of them expressed any regrets about their decision. Now, in light of this research, we can see here that those who support the abortion exception, which, you know, when it comes to the categories of rape and incest, I believe that they're actually creating the conditions for further trauma, not less trauma. And those who say, well, it's going to be less traumatic by allowing them to abort their baby, not necessarily. And to the contrary, research seems to suggest that the abortion itself would be more traumatic than just to carry the baby to full term. Not only that, but this abortion exception also results in the unjust execution of an innocent baby who ends up being punished because of the sins committed by the father. And that's unbiblical. I like the way that Randy Alcorn summed it all up when he declared this. He says, abortion doesn't bring healing to a rape victim. Imposing capital punishment on the innocent child of a sex offender does nothing bad to the rapist and nothing good to the woman. That being the case, we ought to oppose this abortion exception. And the reason why is because the injustice of abortion won't fix the injustice of rape. Just think about that for a little while. And I get it if you're taking issue with what I'm saying right now, but think about it. The injustice of abortion cannot fix the injustice of rape. Or we might just say two wrongs won't make it right. And I realize that this is extremely difficult to hold this position, and most people will oppose it. But I would remind you that we've been called to be loyal to the Lord, not to the opinions of men. We've been called to be loyal to the Lord and not slaves of our own emotions. And according to the Lord, it's wrong to execute a child for the sins of the father. Plain and simple. And so the only way around this is to say that the fetus in the womb is not a child. And I would defy anybody to prove that scientifically. From the moment of conception, biblically speaking, we know there's a child in the womb. And it would be unbiblical for us to abort an unborn baby because their father is a rapist. Well, I know that many of us have to just kind of consider and process and think about these things, and I encourage you to do that, because I have no doubt that there are probably Christians here tonight who have made the argument that, well, abortion's okay in the case of incest and rape. And if that's a position that you've held, I encourage you to prayerfully consider the verse that we've considered here tonight and prayerfully just contemplate how that verse about not punishing a child for the sins of the father should be applied to this topic of abortion. We need to become Christians who are loyal to the Lord and not slaves of our emotions. And with this as the goal, let's continue to consider the way that King Amaziah began to waver in his faith because he was a slave of his own emotions. With this as the focus, if you would look with me here at 2 Chronicles chapter 25, I want to pick up our study beginning there at verse 5. Here Ezra writes, "Moreover, Amaziah gathered Judah together and set over them captains of thousands and captains of hundreds according to their fathers' houses throughout all Judah and Benjamin. And he numbered them from 20 years old and above and found them to be 300,000 choice men able to go to war who could handle spear and shield. He also hired 100,000 mighty men of valor from Israel for 100 talents of silver." Now, here in these verses, we find King Amaziah. He's preparing the army of Judah for the growing threat that was beginning to build there at their southern border. And while we aren't told how King Amaziah knew that they needed to prepare for war with those Edomites, what we do know is that he felt this need to not only put his army in order, but then also he felt the need to hire additional help from the men of Israel. As we consider his decision to hire soldiers from the northern kingdom of Israel, it's my guess that this was nothing more than an emotional decision which was driven by the realization that the army of the Edomites was much, much larger than the army he had there in Judah. Now, if that's the case, well, then it was the fear of the Edomites that led him to this decision. It was the fear of the Edomites, not faith in God, that led him to go and hire 100,000 mighty men of valor from Israel. And this decision was made despite the fact that the Lord was the one who had separated the kingdom of Judah from the kingdom of Israel. But rather than prayerfully seeking divine directions from the Lord, King Amaziah decided to lean on his own understanding by hiring this group of mercenaries from the tribe of Ephraim. It's for this reason that the Lord then sent a prophet to present King Amaziah with a word of correction. And with this in mind, if you would, let's pick up our study of 2 Chronicles chapter 25. I want to begin reading there at verse 7, because here we learn that a man of God came to him saying, "O king, do not let the army of Israel go with you, for the Lord is not with Israel, not with any of the children of Ephraim. But if you go, be gone, be strong in battle. Even so, God shall make you fall before the enemy, for God has power to help and to overthrow." Now, here in these verses, we find this unnamed man of God challenging the king with this word of correction. And we must not fail to notice that the word of correction, well, it had everything to do with the king's decision to seek the help of evil men in order to, you know, help him to fight against other evil men. There were these evil men there in Ephraim. They were given over to idols. Sure, they were children of Israel, but they were completely given over to idolatry. And the Lord at this point in time was saying, "I'm not supporting what's going on there in Israel." And yet the king decided to seek the help of evil men in order to fight against other evil men. Militarily speaking, this is based on the strategy that's typically summed up in this way: the enemy of my enemy is my friend. In other words, the enemy of my enemy is my functional ally for the moment. What King Amaziah was failing to realize was that the army of Judah didn't need help from evil men. The army of Judah didn't need help from mercenaries from Ephraim. No, instead, they simply needed help from the one who is able to give them the victory or overthrow them. With that being the case, the man of God challenged the king of Judah so that he would realize that his faith in the military might of Ephraim was completely misplaced. Would it be to God that leaders here in America would learn the same lesson? That our military leaders would stop looking to, you know, the enemy of our enemy for help and realize that God established this nation because leaders were looking to him, not because we, you know, somehow got help from our enemies who are the enemies of our enemies and therefore our friends. It's completely incorrect thinking. Now, with all this as our focus, let's continue to consider how the king's misplaced faith ended up causing more problems there in the land of Judah. If you would, let's pick up our study of 2 Chronicles 25, beginning at verse 9. Here we learn that Amaziah said to the man of God, "But what shall we do about the 100 talents which I have given to the troops of Israel?" And the man of God answered, "The Lord is able to give you much more than this." So Amaziah discharged the troops that had come to him from Ephraim to go back home. Therefore, their anger was great. Aroused against Judah, and they returned home in great anger. Then Amaziah strengthened himself, and leading his people, he went to the Valley of Salt and killed 10,000 of the people of Seir. Also, the children of Judah took captive 10,000 alive, brought them to the top of the rock, and cast them down from the top of the rock, so that they were all dashed in pieces. But as for the soldiers of the army which Amaziah had discharged, so that they would not go with him to battle, they raided the cities of Judah from Samaria to Beth Horon, killed 3,000 in them, and took much spoil. Now, here in these verses, we learned about the way in which those mercenaries who had been hired from Ephraim exacted their revenge on the king of Judah for sending them home without allowing them to come take part in this battle and cash in on the spoils of war. As King Amaziah and the army of Judah were busy fighting with the Edomites there in the Valley of Salt, which is just below the Dead Sea, the angry Israelites from Ephraim who had been sent home, well, they decided that they were going to take advantage of the missing military from Judah. And it was at that point in time when they invaded the northern region of Judah and they raided the cities from Samaria to Beth Horon. Now, from this, we can see here that those who choose to work with the wicked in order to accomplish the will of God, we'll eventually realize that those who are wicked are wicked. I mean, it seems like a no-brainer, right? You know, yeah, I'm going to go team up with this wicked person who's promised to help me and never turn around and be wicked towards me, right? Come on. If you work with the wicked in an attempt to accomplish something good, I mean, you're basically inviting the wicked to then turn on you eventually. And we shouldn't be surprised when it happens. This is something that, you know, the leaders here in America really need to realize, because this is something that, government leaders have made this error time and time again. But not only, you know, government leaders and military leaders, but also Christian leaders. Leaders in the Christian church struggle to understand this concept. The reason I say this is because, listen, there are many leaders in the modern Christian church who don't really see a problem with hiring mercenaries from Ephraim in order to accomplish what they think is their calling in Christ. I'll give you one example. There are many churches that populate their worship team with unbelieving musicians because they think that the quality of music is more important than the integrity of the musician. It's true. And so you're going to put unbelievers on stage to lead worship? You know, unbelievers who were just getting drunk at the bar the night before, and now they're up on stage leading worship at your church because they're talented? Doesn't make any sense. There are also those who are willing to work together with the cults in order to accomplish good works, like, you know, fighting against abortion or feeding the poor or housing the homeless. These are all great things, of course. But there are Christian leaders who are wavering in their loyalty to the Lord, and they do this by working together with cults in order to accomplish these good works, all the while failing to realize that they're simultaneously validating those very cults. When a Christian leader works together with a Mormon leader and they go out and do an outreach together to feed some hungry people, all the Christian is doing is lending credibility to Mormonism or to the Jehovah's Witnesses, or, I mean, the list just goes on and on, but happens all the time. We haven't been called to work together with unbelievers to try to accomplish God's will. It doesn't make sense. And I get it. You know, there's many who just get into this mindset of, well, there's strength in numbers. And if we have more people on our side, then it's the numbers that matter. Well, that's just a mob rules mentality. Why don't we trust in the one who can either give us the victory or allow us to be overthrown? It's his decision. It doesn't matter how many people we muster together and we've got the bigger team, so we're going to win. That's not a biblical concept. We have to be careful with this idea that, you know, we can work together with the wicked in order to accomplish something good. Listen, as soon as the wicked get upset with us, guess what they're going to do? Well, listen, when Christian leaders validate the cults, they also cause others to begin wavering in their loyalty to the Lord as well. And with this as the focus, let's pick up our study of 2 Chronicles chapter 25. If you would look with me there, beginning at verse 14, here Ezra writes, "Now it was so, after Amaziah came from the slaughter of the Edomites, that he brought the gods of the people of Seir, set them up to be his gods, and bowed down before them and burned incense to them. Therefore, the anger of the Lord was aroused against Amaziah, and he sent him a prophet who said to him, 'Why have you sought the gods of the people which could not rescue their own people from your hand?'" "So it was, as he talked with him, that the king said to him, 'Have we made you the king's counselor? Cease. Why should you be killed?' Then the prophet ceased and said, 'I know that God has determined to destroy you because you have done this and have not heeded my advice.'" Here in these verses, we find King Amaziah leading the people of Judah to worship the false gods of the Edomites. And it's sad to say that he was unable to hear the word of wisdom that came from the prophet of God. The prophet of God came and pointed out how the gods of the Edomites were powerless to save the Edomites. Listen, if you can pick up your God and drag him back to Israel from Edom, not a very powerful God. Think about it for a moment. Why would they turn away from the true and living Lord who just gave them the victory over the Edomites, then turn around and worship the lifeless idol which was unable to save the previous owners? It makes absolutely no sense, and yet this is what happens in the mind of those who are given over to idolatry. If you worship a senseless idol, you become like the idol. Senseless. This was precisely the point that Paul is making in Romans chapter 1, where he declares, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. Therefore, God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lusts of their heart to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen." These people who begin to worship the creature, or in other words, the creation, rather than the Creator. Those who embrace these idols that look like, you know, combinations of men and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things and all these sorts of things. Listen, those who exchange the truth for any lie, they may profess to be wise as they do it, and yet Paul says they've become fools. And the longer they continue in their foolishness, the Lord then gives them over to their futile thoughts as their foolish hearts become more and more and more darkened. Does this sound like what's happening in the world today? we've got professors at colleges who don't understand basic biology anymore, and who are forbidden from saying, that's a boy, that's a girl. And yet they think they're so smart. They think they're so intelligent. And yet they can no longer make sense of basic biology. And they'll tell you abortion is okay, that it's the woman's choice. And if you respond by asking, when does life begin? They don't know. So wait, you don't know when life begins? So it's okay to potentially take a life? It makes no sense. I could just go ramble on and on and on for hours of just of the lunacy that I see happening in the world around me. And it's just getting worse and worse and worse because people are given over to idolatry. And the foolish hearts of many have become darkened, and they can no longer make sense out of basic concepts. In order to further grasp the point that I want to make here, let's continue to consider the idolatry of Amaziah and how it resulted in a darkened heart that brought on foolish pride. If you would look with me here at 2 Chronicles chapter 25, I want to begin reading at verse 17, because here we learn that Amaziah, king of Judah, asked advice and sent to Joash, the son of Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, king of Israel, saying, come, let us face one another in battle. And Joash, king of Israel, sent to Amaziah, king of Judah, saying, the thistle that was in Lebanon sent to the cedar that was in Lebanon, saying, give your daughter to my son as wife, and a wild beast that was in Lebanon passed by and trampled the thistle. Oh, man, indeed, you say that you have defeated the Edomites, and your heart is lifted up to boast. Stay at home now. Why should you meddle with trouble that you should fall, you and Judah with you? But Amaziah would not heed, for it came from God that he might give them into the hand of their enemies because they sought the gods of Edom. Here in these verses, we find King Amaziah filled with all manner of foolish pride. He started worshiping idols. And as he worshiped a senseless idol, he himself became senseless. And in his senselessness, his heart was filled with pride. And he thought, yeah, I can take on the king of Israel now. It's my guess that he truly believed that he was about to, you know, defeat the king of Israel so that he could then restore the entire land of promise back into one single kingdom under the leadership of David's descendants, namely himself. And so he consulted with his advisors to see if his plan made sense to them. And lo and behold, you know, all of his yes men said yes. And so he decided to invite the king of Israel to the battlefield. And while it's true that King Joash assured the king of Judah in a very illustrative, artistic way that he was about to be crushed, Amaziah was so blinded by his own foolish pride that he couldn't listen to reason. According to Ezra, the Lord was allowing the king of Judah to follow this foolish pride so that he might receive the punishment that he deserved for introducing the idols of the Edomites into Judah. And that's exactly what happens here in the final verses of this chapter. If you would, let's pick up our study of 2 Chronicles 25, beginning at verse 21. Here we learn that Joash, king of Israel, went out, and he and Amaziah, king of Judah, faced one another at Beth Shemesh, which belongs to Judah. And Judah, though they had the home court advantage, Judah was defeated by Israel, and every man fled to his tent. Then Joash, the king of Israel, captured Amaziah, king of Judah, the son of Joash, the son of Jehoahaz, at Beth Shemesh, and he brought him to Jerusalem and broke down the wall of Jerusalem from the gate of Ephraim to the corner gate 400 cubits. And he took all the gold and silver, all the articles that were found in the house of God with Obed-Edom, the treasures of the king's house, and hostages, and returned to Samaria. Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, lived 15 years after the death of Joash, the son of Jehoahaz, king of Israel. Now the rest of the acts of Amaziah, from the first to the last, Indeed, are they not written in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel? After the time that Amaziah turned away from following the Lord, they made a conspiracy against him in Jerusalem, and he fled to Lachish. But they sent after him to Lachish and killed him there. And they brought him on horses and buried him with his fathers in the city of Judah. Now, here in the final verses of this chapter, we find what I believe to be a perfect example of what King Solomon meant when he declared, "Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall." You see, it was the pride of King Amaziah that led him to his destruction. And it was his haughty spirit that resulted in the fall of Judah. And as we consider the tragic end of his life, I can't help but to wonder how his life might have been different had his heart remained loyal to the Lord. How might his life been different if he would have just been devoted to the Lord? Sadly, the heart of Amaziah wasn't completely committed to the Lord, and as a result, you know, he started worshiping the idols of the Edomites, and then his idolatry quickly resulted in delusional thinking that led him to believe that he had, you know, the military might necessary to go and defeat the army of Israel. And at the end of the day, you know, Judah was defeated. And the king of Israel came in and took all of the treasures from the temple as well as from the king's palace, and he went on to die a complete failure. Christian, listen, those who fail to walk with the Lord with wholehearted devotion, they eventually find themselves given over to delusional ideas that stem from sinful idolatries. You see, if your heart's not completely devoted to the Lord, then your heart is going to be completely devoted to something else. And whatever that something else is, that's your idol. Whatever it is, fill in the blank. Jobs, cars, children, vacations, whatever. Whatever you put in the place that God deserves in your heart, that is your idol. Sadly, oftentimes, our idol looks pretty much exactly like ourselves. Just a little skinnier. And when we become worshipers of ourselves, we find ourselves, you know, thinking senseless thoughts, delusional thoughts that lead us down a path of destruction. In contrast to this, those who will simply dedicate their hearts to the Lord with steadfast loyalty, we will be blessed as the Lord establishes every step that we take. I like the way that King David put it in the 37th Psalm. There where he declares, "Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and feed on his faithfulness. Delight yourself also in the Lord, and he shall give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust also in him, and he shall bring it to pass. He shall bring forth your righteousness as the light and your justice as the noonday." Christian, listen, if you've truly placed your trust in the Lord Jesus Christ, then let's also make sure that we're committing our ways to him completely. And rather than leaning on our own understanding as we make our daily decisions, let's instead make sure that our heart is first loyal to the Lord so that we can become those believers who, much like David, are people after God's own heart. Let's commit our hearts to the Lord with steadfast loyalty, and let's allow him to lead us on the narrow path of righteousness. And as we continue to learn how to walk by faith with the King of Kings, we can rejoice in knowing that he will give us the divine direction that we need so that we can make good and godly decisions for his glory. Let's pray.